from 6 on 2FM.
Thanks to the two Johnnies, it's Monday the 12th of June and this is Game On. Coming up today, we've epic finishes to dissect in the Leinster and Munster Hurling Finals.
Hairman goes to ground, now driving forward is Adam Hogan,
free.
The youngster.
Has to be free!
So free, that's unbelievable.
Oh my God!
The game is over, Limerick have done it.
A controversial
finish to the game. Clare denied a late free, inexplicably. And the talk of the Limerick demise was premature. They're still alive, they're still winning. They've done the five in a row in Munster.
Plays it into John Donnelly. A chance of a goal perhaps for Kilkenny. They strike it now and it's a goal!
Killian Buckley
has played it low and hard and the 2-point advantage for Galway has been wiped out and the 5 minutes are up. It's 4-21 to 2-26. A 1-point lead and a 1-point game and a 1-point win. Unbelievable finish.
Yes, high drama at the Gaelic Grounds and in Croke Park, and we'll have more on that with Niall Moran shortly. Meanwhile in soccer, Alan Cawley and Stephen Kelly will start our build up to a big week for Stephen Kenny's Ireland, and plus, because we have to remain neutral, we will take stock on Man City's treble.
The ball on the way, Gossens and Edison saves it. Down to the referee now, how many more seconds? There it is, it's over, it's done. Manchester City make it to the top of the mountain. They win the Champions League for the very first time. The players all hit the deck, some of them crying. Pep Guardiola joins that elite club of managers who've won this competition for the third time.
Plus, we'll hear from Conor Nyland and David Gillick on career milestones for Novak Djokovic in tennis and Rashida Adeleke on the track.
Adeleke has the crowd, but Wilson has the lead. It is closer than we expected to be. Here comes Adeleke. Oh my gosh, this is a huge upset. This seals it for Texas. Ooh! And at 49-20, she just misses the collegiate record.
Well, there's so much upside to Rashida Adeleke. Every time she runs the 400 meters, she runs a personal best. She represents Ireland. She's got every record.
Yes, we could have done with an Irish person commentating on that race. But if you want to get in touch, you can text us on 51552 or tweet at Game On 2FM.
Game On 2FM.
Or I meant Irish person, Marie, just to correct myself there. I didn't mean Irish man. But it must have been a happy house, your house. Thank God for the Tailteann Cup, Marie.
Big fan of the Tailteann Cup now. Wasn't always a big fan of the Tailteann Cup, but you know, I've came round. Do you know what, Ruby? It was great. It was great for Laois to get that win over Fermanagh, to go up to Fermanagh and get the win. I think a lot of people don't appreciate or understand the amount of work that goes into being an inter-county manager. It is a very tough job and there are only a couple of teams who get reward at the end. Well, only two really, because you know, if you don't win, you lose. Is that right, Ruby? So
there's only that's pretty much the way it goes,
yeah,
Marie.
There's only two teams at the end. I was delighted. I was delighted that Billy's team got that win because they do put a huge amount of work in, and sometimes things don't go their way, and sometimes they do. And this was the weekend that they did, so it was brilliant.
It was a brilliant. And just for those of you who don't know, Billy Sheehan is, of course, Marie's much better other half. Now, Marie, give us the lowdown. What was going on when the game was over? It was a bit of argy-bargy there when they were heading for the tunnel. I was watching.
Yeah, do you know, a couple of people said that to
me.
Oh,
I didn't ask him. Go on.
I did ask him.
The party
absolutely
line.
Absolutely. No, I will tell you. He said that they did go head-to-head during the game, but afterwards they worked it out and they had a good chat and they were talking about inter-county management and how difficult it can be when you have a young family and you're trying to commit to training a team 3, 4, 5 times a week, whatever it is, and all the work that goes into it. So they the Fermanagh manager has young children as well, so they found some common ground and they had a good old chat.
Well, I'm struggling for 2 nights a week for doing the 14, so I tip my hat to them for 5 nights a week.
I think anyone that gets into coaching and management, myself and Al here now, are in the very early days of our careers, but it is a really tough slog. And when you're in a county or on a team that you know, you might be in a league or you're up against like a Man City or whoever it is, you know, a Dublin or a Kerry, things are always going to be difficult. But
isn't that why, though, Marie, I think, and we often debate this regularly on the show in terms of the level of competition. That's why the Tailteann Cup is there, because you would have thought of all the hard days Billy has had so far. You've dealt with them and had to listen to them and had to see him probably going through hell with some of the results, and obviously the bad beating to Dublin. Now they're in a competition where it's more of a level playing field, and he gets his day where he has a chance to win, and now he can look forward to maybe the next round as well.
Just to cut across here, my favourite, and I'm not going into it on air, Marie, but my favourite description of somebody getting over a defeat was you describing Billy after the Dublin game.
It's
like a funeral. You're answering the door.
Like, it absolutely is. Like, because,
of course.
Yeah, like,
you win or lose.
You win or lose, and you're trying to, deal with things that don't go your way, and then you have to analyse everything. And you also, and look, no more than Brian Lowen and Henry Scheffner are going to have to do today. Like, it doesn't matter how big the county is, whether it's a final. Like, every game to those players is so important, because they've worked so hard and they're given everything all through the year. So, like, they have to lift the team up again, you know, and they have to lift themselves up and then try and raise a panel of 30 people. Like, I don't know, I can't even do it with the under sevens when they lose at the weekend. So
that's life, guys. We all have to get up and go again tomorrow. It's all life lessons. Isn't that what they call them? Absolutely. Life is full of disappointments. Get up and move on. Anyway, it's about winners, so we're going to talk about their biggest winner of the weekend.
Yeah, but before we do that, I want to make one tiny point, right? We're talking about management. And I have a rival manager. I have somebody who I manage against.
Yeah.
With the under sevens. And he's on the line. David Gillick and I go head to head on the sidelines. So there you go.
This is the real stuff.
This is the real stuff.
Now we get the real lowdown.
And we slag about it, and we're talking about players, and we meet, and we used to talk about, you know, athletics. Now we're like, well, how did your team get on this weekend? And, you know, I'm sizing up the opposition. I'm looking at his son Oscar thinking, can my son David take him?
Tell the real truth. How do you deal with the parents?
David?
Silence. We're not answering that one, are we not?
We're not talking about parents on here. Absolutely not.
We're talking to me here on parents, are we?
Well, we're not going today, but we're going to leave that. You know, we're going to leave the parents, because that's the most difficult part of it. How are you,
well,
David, anyway?
I'm good. I'm sitting here, okay, and Oscar's actually in earshot of you. So I was trying to explain to him that when Bradford played Temple Oak, that's the real, the nitty gritty rivalry that takes place up around Marley Park. So I can vouch for you, Marie. You're okay in the sideline. You're one of those good coaches.
Give it time.
The mind of coaching under sevens, now that's wonderful. And your ball, Craig, give yourself a pat in the back. What about Radhisha Adeleke? That's all we want to talk about.
Yeah, like, you know, where do you start? Like, what a weekend in terms of Irish athletics. You know, it's the first sprint NCAA title, you know, for Ireland. 49-2, to put that in context, like, you're talking about a time that would have medalled at the last Olympic Games, would have won silver, would have won silver at the last World Championships. It's that good. And when you consider, like, at the age of 20, running that fast, and even in the way she did it over the weekend, you know, you're talking about someone who is new to the event. She went to the University of Texas, you know, she's in her third year there now, but she went as kind of more or less a 200 meter athlete. And then last year we saw the, you know, the time she ran over 400 meters in the World Champs in the semi-final, then went on to Munich. And this is after the NCAA season, which I think she had about 50 races in her legs, but she's still at that level, produced the goods. And, you know, this year started training with the 400 meter group over in the University of Texas, and has just got quicker and quicker, you know, to go from sub 50 to mid 49s to then produce an amazing run when it mattered in the NCAA final with a 49.2, third fastest time in the year, or in the world this year. It shows, like, what we're dealing with here. And, you know, realistically, we're talking about someone that could medal at a global athletic championships. She's that good.
It's so exciting watching her and just seeing her take it all in her stride, and the improvements that she's made. In her post-race interview, she said she only started training for the 400 metres in October. You're a former 400 metre runner, David. What does that mean? Like, what changes will she have made from the shorter distances to what she's doing in 400 training that's been able to elevate her to this level so quickly?
It's a big change, because then you're looking at, you know, lactate tolerance, you're looking at speed endurance, you know, most sessions you are literally getting scraped off the track. And she kind of alluded to that, you know, her training has just got so much harder. But that's 400 metres. And I think for someone who, you know, to be fair, you know, when she was here in Dublin, she's training over in Tala, and her coach Daniel Kilgallen, and, you know, even in school, you could see that with her height, her leg length, her stride length, she was probably destined for 400 metres, you know. But her base speed, and this is the great thing that she's done with Floreal, her coach over in the States, they've worked on kind of getting her faster. So she's improved over 100 and 200 metres. And that's enabled her now to almost, like, virtually jog through the first 200 of a 400. She's that quick over the shorter distances. And that enables her then to, you know, pretty much put her in world-class territory and building on that strength. And we saw that in the last 50 metres on Saturday night. Like, she just literally pulled away from the whole field. And you're talking about pulling away from Britton Wilson, who's the lane insider. That's an athlete that's run the second fastest time over 400 in the world this year. And she's pulling away from
her.
She ran
a perfect race.
She has. But there was things built about the great rivalry between them. And that's the thing that fascinates me about Rashida. Like, she handled that extremely well. And even within the race, you know, from 200 to 300, she got attacked by Wilson, the lane insider. But she stayed calm and patient, and then was able to unleash that kind of strong kick finish. So that bodes really well for the future, but it also shows that the great work that they've done in her speed endurance. She's getting faster over the 200, but yet she's enabled to build that strength into her game, and that's what's really pulling her across the line, you know. And again, these times, I think when you look at someone who is running 49.2 in her first solid season over one lap, you're kind of looking at someone who could potentially go even quicker and into the 48s. And if she's doing that, you know, not only looking podium, you know, let's kind of get excited. She could, you know, she could go all the way.
David, she's 20. This is your forte. How much more improvement is there with age? Will she get better?
Yeah, she will. I think she will. Now, look, that's very easy to say she will. And you look at her times this year, but she is 20. Probably the biggest conundrum that's going to face her now is whether she stays as kind of an amateur NCAA athlete, or does she go and turn pro. So again, turning pro in the States means that you align yourself with, say, a gear company, but you forego your collegiate career. So essentially, you won't be involved in NCAAs anymore. You will get involved in the Diamond Leagues, et cetera, et cetera. And your main priority will be the international kind of global athletic championships. So what are those implications for her? Does that mean she has to change coach or environment or training partners? And that's probably the biggest thing that she will be dealing with now in the days and the weeks post NCAAs. And it's a big decision, because that will kind of dictate her priorities for next year. You know, you've obviously got Paris, and that's the big thing. But if she stays as a collegiate athlete, it's all about the NCAAs in June. So it's very hard to peak and get that spot on in one season. Can you peak twice in a season? Extremely hard to do. So I think that's what we need to kind of look at right now. What way is the next kind of couple of weeks and months going to unfold for Rashida Adeleke, with a view of the Worlds in Budapest and then onwards on to Paris?
Who'd be advising her there, David?
Yeah, it's a good question, Marie, because technically she wouldn't have an agent as a NCAA athlete. It'll be all kind of through her coach and probably through the university. But, like, she has to, like, the thing about it is, right, these days you get great insight into sports people through their social media. And when you look at Rashida, she is in a great environment. She has a really good relationship with her coach and the trainer partners, and that team environment, I think, is really special to her. And you could see that even with her post-race interviews. It was about herself, and she was very happy with that, but one thing she spoke an awful lot about is about the team. So I think a lot of the communication will be through her coach now, and she would rely heavily on her coach. So again, I don't know the ins and outs of the relationship there, in terms of, does he have a pro group that she could easily slot into, or is he solely looking after collegiate athletes? You know, if it is, say, the pro group, well, then that would bode really well for her making the decision to potentially, say, go pro, but doesn't change her environment. So right now, there will be agents sniffing around it, because she's got huge potential. So, you know, agents will be looking at it, I can make money out of this person. But right now, it would be through a coach and that kind of core group that she'd be spending day in, day out with.
You're her, with her talent. Mm-hmm. What would you do?
To be honest, I would be looking at, I would try and keep my environment and my coaching setup as the same. That would be my priority. But I'd be looking at turning pro. I think my priority would have to switch to Paris. Like, it's next year. If I had the opportunity, I would put everything kind of into that plan and work towards Paris, with the opportunity to maybe you know, medal there, because it only comes around once every 4 years, you know. That, for me, would be where I'd be looking.
How long, what's the longevity of an athlete like her? When will she reach her peak, and then how long does she go for?
Yeah, like, again, it's very event specific. You know, if you're looking at the sprint events and you're looking at the long sprint events, you could argue that you're looking somewhere between 25 to maybe 27, 28. There obviously is a few that have gone on further than that and competed and won medals, you know, into the late 20s, early 30s. But generally speaking, yeah, you're looking at kind of your mid to late 20s to really kind of... you know, to really kind of hit the markers that you want. The other thing as well that has to be kind of factored in is, like, the NCAA, the setup is very, it's tough. Like, they run a lot of weekends from indoors at the start of the year all the way up to June. So there's a lot of races and a lot of, like, relays and 4x1s and 4x4s that, I'd say, a lot of European athletes who wouldn't be exposed to the NCAA setup wouldn't have to do. So, you know, you have to look at that. Again, from a sprint event, you know, they're putting their bodies through an awful lot day in, day out, and that can take its toll. So, like, the other side of it is, when you're talking about a 20-year-old, we have to be aware and cognizant that, like, they're 20. Do you know, it's like there's a lot of, like, life factors come into it in the next couple of years, and, you know, from professional standpoint to a personal standpoint, so all of that has to be factored in. But, you know, if we were looking at success being a straight line, you know, Rashida's probably got 10 years ahead of her in the game at a very high level.
That's exciting, isn't it? It's exciting from our point of view, and of course from her point of view as well. And I guess, look, she's a long way from home too. But, like, David, you've been in the States. In terms of the market and the popularity of the athletes over there, like, what's the potential there in terms of stardom for Adeleke?
Well, I'm telling you now, like in terms of global athletics, everybody looks at the NCAAs. Everybody looks to see who's come through the NCAA rank, who's running fast times. And right now, there will be an awful lot of people will be looking at Rashida Adeleke as the next star of athletics. Like, that's how good she is. At that young age, what she's doing, her progression, there'll be an awful lot of brands and agents and everything like that sniffing around, because she's got all the potential that, you know, a star in the making has. And, you know, when you consider her age and her times that she's running now, like, you know, historically, it's a very, very fast time. Now, it has to be said, the event is tough, and the event is probably getting a little bit faster. You know, you're looking at some seriously talented athletes running over one lap and getting faster, like Sydney McLaughlin, the world record holder over 400 meter hurdles, is now targeting the 400 meter flat to break the world record. You know, you've got people who, you know, have been really, really strong over the last couple of years, and, you know, we talk about, say, a 49.2 kind of medaling. Yes, it could potentially medal, but, you know, you're probably looking at the 48s to be really in with a shout to medal. And, you know, I think Rashida can do that. So, like, her pulling power from a marketing perspective, you know, she's got everything going for her right now, and I think her performances are backing that up, and I think she's only going to go and get better and get quicker if the environment and if coaching setup and all that kind of suits, because this is where the business comes into it. And, you know, a lot of brands, shoe brands who offer the big contracts, they align themselves with world-class coaches. So if she was to align herself with a certain brand, you know, part of that may mean she has to go to a certain coach, and that's a huge change to a young athlete and a young athlete's coaching environment. So all of that kind of has to be factored in, and that's where, you know, yes, people are getting really excited about Budapest this year or even Paris. Like, let's see where she is in, like, you know, 6 weeks to 2 months' time. And I think, you know, right now she probably needs a bit of a break off the NCAAs, maybe go back into a bit of a training block, come out, maybe do a couple of ones and twos, and then maybe come into Europe, do a couple of Diamond Leagues before the Worlds, maybe. Like, and again, this is just me kind of going, what would I do in that in these circumstances? But, you know, it's really exciting. It's very exciting. But it's also, we have to remember, she still is only 20.
I'm here after looking up Michael Johnson's career, the greatest 400 metre athlete of all time, and I'm thinking she could be Ireland's version. He was 25 before he won an Olympic medal. Like, at 400 metre, and he went on then to Sydney. That was Atlanta and Sydney. Like, she has age on her side, like, so it's, does she have someone to mind her?
Yeah, like this, and you're right, Ruby, because that's a massive factor. Like, it's a huge thing. You're away from home. I think she will be based in the States going forward. I think, you know, the environment over there, her teammates and all that sort of ecosystem that she's now found herself in is working really, really well. But you need someone that's going to look after you. You need a core group that you can trust in, you can confide in. Because let's be honest, like, sport is sport. It's all great now. We're kind of looking at it, that how great the weekend was, and we all kind of think about the future championships, but there's going to be ups and downs, and there's going to be times where she's going to question herself, defeats, injuries, all that is going to come. So, you know, having a robust structure around you is extremely important, particularly when you're away from home. And I think that's worked for her over in Texas. And, you know, again, I refer to, you know, the whole concept of the NCAA is, like, she kept referring to, oh, I won it for the team, it's all about the team, because University of Texas was defending their NCAA title on home turf, and they needed Rashid Adeleke to score maximum points in that race, and she did. And that's what one of the things she celebrated the most, is I did it for the team. And that's fantastic, because she's with like-minded people. Like, I can guarantee, you know, when she's gone down training, like, 49.2, as much as we're looking at 49.2 going, it's an amazing time, she'd be training with people who are probably, you know, thereabouts, sub 50, the low 50 seconds. They probably don't even know the automatic qualifications for the Worlds or Olympic Games. They're on that above level, like, it's that mindset. So, again, I think it's great that she's in that environment, because she's not going to get pulled into all the hype. And I think that's really important for a young person as well. It's just to focus on the game and what their kind of, you know, their priorities are, and not getting too carried away about kind of the medals and what might happen. So I think that core group is really, really important to her.
And she seems to enjoy her college course as well. She's spoken about that quite a bit too. So there's a lot to be said for getting the education. David Gillick, thank you so much. I'd say you're off training or something by the sound of the bouncing ball behind you there. But I will...
I'm sorry about that. That's Oscar now. Oscar's giving me the eyes here.
He's getting the extra...
He's
getting the extra training in after I called him out for David being able to take him. I'll talk to you later, David. Bye.
See you later, guys.
Bye. Okay, we're going to take a quick break, and Niall Moran is up next to talk about the weekend's hurling action.
Game on.
Check out the podcast on the RTE Radio Player app.
Game on.
Hurling.
Welcome back to Game On. So yesterday saw two epic hurling matches to decide Munster and Leinster, and I'd say we're going to start in Munster. Marie, will we start there? I think we should, just to rub it into Marie Crowe.
Well, since we have a Limerick man on the line, we should probably start with Limerick.
No. We have to, don't we now? We have to start with Marie. Go on, Marie, what happened?
Give him first right to reply there, Ruby.
Definitely. I'm not going to start arguing about three at the end, because they had enough chances to win the game, and... you know, you look at last year's Munster final and you think that they left everything out there. They probably had a little bit more that they could have done, I thought. Yesterday, Brian Lowen could have made a couple of changes quicker. There was a few opportunities that they, maybe on a different day, would have taken, but you can't really have any arguments when it's against a team like Limerick. Like, they're phenomenal. The way they're able to go to the well all the time, and even just, I was watching John Kiley, and it was Alan Cunningham, and I saw Paul Kinnerk floating around there as well. Like, the fact, and now you'll be able to shed light on this, that they've been able to get what they have out of this group of lads season after season, the way they're able to make the decisions at the right time, the way they're able to just keep having them performing when it matters, is for me just the epitome of brilliance when it comes to management.
Yeah, you'd have to concur. I suppose the longevity of success has probably been, definitely from the Limerick stance, has been unique. But, like, again, nothing really comes out from within the camp, but the little bits that you get, you tend to learn that numbers play a huge role. And I suppose what they pride themselves on is hitting numbers right the way across. And for, I suppose, most of us supporters going into a game yesterday, we would have felt that it would have been about the emotion of the occasion, not to be outdone in your home patch. I suppose not to have your near neighbours have bragging rights, but I suppose for that group, they were probably most concerned about their numbers, keeping hitting in their tackles counts, etc. And I suppose it's probably not as sexy as we'd like to have it. We'd like to see that there's a picture up on the wall and whatever it is, trying to use as motivation too. But for Limerick yesterday, the work rate just upped, and I suppose Brian touched on it there at the end. So their shooting efficiency was superior to Clare, and that was the only difference. And again, look, I really have to just tip my hat to Clare. I thought they were outstanding yesterday. I thought they really brought the fight. When the game looked to be slipping away from after 50, 55 minutes, when the Leicester team would have fallen apart, Clare kept on coming at them. And they are not gone by any means, by any stretch of the imagination. It would take an amazing team to beat Clare for a second time in this championship. And I suppose the key is how quickly they can recover. And so that's really the key lesson that they'll have learned from last year. And one thing, the one approach they can't adapt here is the sorry me approach. And look, whatever happened at the end, yeah, it was a free, of course it was. But if it happened in the first minute, would we still be talking about it? Again, as a Limerick person, we would have had grievances in the first half with some of the way the decisions went. So again, not to be rubbing salt into their injury, but Park had put it behind them, and like they're very, very close, and it takes a lot of work to get that close year on year. So now is when the real work again will start for him.
In fairness to Brian Lowen, he is the opposite of a poor me kind of guy anyway. He's a shoulder to the wheel, let's try and improve where we can, and just bring even more work rate if possible. That's kind of the person that he is. But Noel, just before we move on to Clare, just on Limerick, given the fact that somebody like you played for such a long time with them and didn't get success like we're seeing now, and you know, had some tough times, and there was definitely struggles around Limerick hurling. There were so many questions asked. Can you even understand the situation or I guess enjoy the moment that you're in, given how hard it was to get there and what you experienced yourself? Can you even believe where they're at?
Yeah, oftentimes when you get the opportunity to talk here, you'd nearly be embarrassed talking. And even talking to some of the lads there, fellas that we'd played it over the last 24 hours, and he said, geez, lads, would we have been better off eating ice creams and snack boxes on the way to training, on the way home from training, for what we achieved ultimately? But I suppose it's like everything. Again, you can't believe what they have achieved, but there's lots of people who kind of put their shoulders to the wheel to make those things happen. And even when things were going against us as a county, we always, you know what I mean, we were never far away. And I know, like, those days there when you'd be losing games by a point that you could have won, and we had a lot of hard luck stories. We're probably the orchestrators of our own downfall. But so the key to this is, look, the structures, and it's been well documented, the structures have been in place. We have a generation group, and we have a generation group of people who are over them. And I suppose, again, it's I've referenced it before, it's the next All-Ireland that the next group of players will win will be the ultimate legacy to what this group have achieved, because they are the greatest, bar none, in the history of our proud history here in Limerick. And again, Marie, I think one of the things is they're not finished yet, and that's the way they view things. And I suppose that's part of the legacy of the great teams. And I know from here on in, they have two games towards winning All-Ireland and being four in a row, and maybe who knows what next year will bring if that was to be achieved.
It's a funny one. I'm the neutral here, listening to the two of you talking away. And I watched yesterday and I'm thinking, like, Kyle Hayes, Tom Morrissey, Aaron Gillan, David Reedy. And then you look at the other side, Rory Hayes, Tony Kelly, Shane O'Donnell, Mark Rogers. Just as for the game of hurling, like the players that are playing, the commitment they have, the skill that they have, it's incredible to watch for someone whose sport isn't even hurling. It's amazing, Niall.
It's remarkable, right? And again, like Saturday night, we saw a Champions League final. These guys have been paid so much, and do you know what I mean? Yeah, they gave it themselves. They kind of gave it themselves. But like, you see some of the hits. Like, guys were gassed. There'll be 15 minutes left in that game. Like, I've never seen guys were gassed for oxygen. Like, do you know what I mean? To be in the arena like that with that pressure, like, and to be just flat to the mat. I can't tip my hat enough to these guys, because do you know what? It's so easy to come on here and talk and. So the clearness of afterthought and etc., and try and pontificate and make judgments, when these guys, what they have to do in real time, you're fighting for survival, you're fighting for oxygen all day, every day at that level. And like, there has been, what, over the course of the last four games, they're all square. For the last four games, these two teams are all square. Yet today, it's all about what Clare did wrong, and it's all about what Limerick did right. But for me, it's just like, the part of a personality, and this was human features, whereby that just resilience, resolve. I think we've seen it right the way throughout the year in a lot of games in Munster, but I suppose even yesterday, if we move it on to the Leinster final in Kilkenny, to see what Killian Buckley did, who's had a kind of tumultuous 2 years, you have to turn around and give the performance he gave, and capped by obviously a last minute goal. Like, these guys are heroes of children and adults for a reason.
And now, look, we do need to analyse it as well. And, you know, we can look at all the greatness over the last day or so, and the performances and what they give. But towards the end of that game, the last minute or so, should the referee have handled things differently?
Yeah, you could have given a free at the end, Marie. I suppose, look, if you're to be clinical in your judgment, look, Clare got it very wrong in Keane Nolan being picked, and that's irrespective of the space and things that are in front of him. In Paul Flanagan and Shane Amore, they're two outstanding proven backs. You didn't need to reach for a kind of a left field decision. And again, that's probably the frustration that will be from Clare's management. They didn't learn from Leinster. I suppose, obviously, in real time, when they were totally dominant there before half time, they needed to kick on. They didn't. And I suppose coming down the home stretch again, and that oxygen got thin, and like they had Limerick on the rack. As a Limerick person, I thought we were beaten. I really did think we were beaten. And I suppose just didn't get the shots away. Even seeing Tony's two shots blocked the way they were, I've never seen that before. So I suppose they have to take kind of. They have to kind of address those things going forward. So like that's being clinical about it. If you're to blame the referee, Joe Marie, to be honest, yeah, it was a free. Of course, it was a free, but. There was lots of decisions in the first half, and as a Limerick person for the referee coming off at half-time, we were aggrieved too. So if you're relying on last-minute decisions over the course of a 76-minute game, then you're playing a fool's game. Like it's going to cost you ultimately.
To be devil's advocate and all of that, was the game not over about 15 seconds before the foul was committed?
I thought that was out of Ruby. I said it. The game was up. The time was up. Mickey Quaid, when he went to take the last puck out before Limerick hit a wide, I think the clock was on about 73, 57 or 58. By the time that ball ended, time was up. So they got a chance in my head that wasn't there. But again, look, we're fighting over a small fry, like, you know, as in you just have to leave yourself with enough scope to win the game. And as we've seen there for oftentimes with Kenny, do you know what I mean? They always seem to find enough time to win the games, and they're never judged on these decisions. And so for teams to get to the top level, they cannot be relying. They have to leave enough space that they are ahead, that they're not relying on fate taking an evil twist against them.
But to me, this is a conversation we shouldn't even be having when you think of the brilliance of the game. So could the GAA not implement something to remove these conversations? Should there not be a siren that signals the end of the game, and then when the ball goes dead, it's over? Or could you do something to take away needless conversations like this that shouldn't happen after a brilliant match like we had? Should there be a change to the rules?
No, look, the reality of it is they told me 4 minutes of injury time was signaled. The ref knew it was 4 minutes gone. He decided to take a human judgment, I suppose, as so often happens in these games. And he plays, and so the human element of somebody is you give it a chance to draw up. Yeah, of course, it's just sirens. And we set off a whole new debate here, Ruby. It's like we can talk about the helmets being taken off to try and get breaks in play. We can talk about head injuries being in play. We can talk about all these things. But the reality of it was, look, he's a human in the middle of the end of the day. He decided to play on, give him another chance, and so he didn't take that chance. And look, I don't think there's anybody really dwelling on the time element of it. You know? And I do think, look, the bigger picture is that these two teams will live to fight another day. And just one of the other things there, Ruby, right? As in, it was just such a stupendous occasion, and one of the greatest, most final occasions I can ever remember. And to see the excitement on people, you know what I mean, going to the match, and obviously the disappointment that people will have here today, obviously in Clare and the elation in Limerick. But let's not forget, it's only a game. So apart from yesterday, I talked back to the Walsh family in Six Mile Bridge, who 6 weeks earlier had gone to watch the round robin game and came home without their dad. And I suppose, look, obviously the storied history of Teddy McCarthy was celebrated yesterday, but I think as Ronnie Vian has been saying, I kind of just said a little prayer myself for that family, because I can only imagine how difficult it was for them. So for us to be fighting over small fry about time or decision, we're very lucky here today that that's all we had to worry about.
Yeah, that's a very good point. Well made. And in the Galway game as well, and Kilkenny game, it was brilliant to hear him being spoken about after the game in post-match interviews, Teddy McCarthy, that is, as well. So lots of players having the presence of mind to celebrate those that, and remember those that aren't with us. But on that Kilkenny-Galway game, Kilkenny obviously doing what Kilkenny do, but what does this mean for Galway now, and particularly Henry Shefflin? How difficult a task does he have?
I think it'll be a lot more difficult for Galway than what it'll be for Clare to react. Like, Galway had done so much to get into a position where they're 2 points ahead, and they were in control of their destiny. And do you know what I mean? So in the last seconds of the game, it just needed somebody for a little bit of clarity, just kill the ball, sit over it, put it out for 65, put it out for a sideline, and just for the circumstances in which they cocked up the goal. Again, similar to what happened in 2004 for Wexford against Kilkenny, when we saw Cody drop to his knees. It was roles reversed yesterday for Kilkenny, and that, I think, will have an impact on Galway in psychologically more so than what it probably should. They're going to have to dust themselves down very quickly because Tipperary are very dangerous animals coming at them, and there's not going to be anything much between those two teams. But look, again, for Henry, what do you say? Like, they started like a train 6 points to one up. Again, Kilkenny did what they did to come back. Kilkenny got grips of them. Galway were 8 points down. Game looked to be sailing away from them, and yet they brought it back to 2 points up. So, like, you have to say positives on that. They are still a very, very good team. They need to get over very quickly, though, because Tipperary are going to be a dangerous animal coming at them. They will be delighted. Conor Whelan has done what we've all said he's capable of doing, lighting up the stage. And so, I mean, I suppose Evan Nyland, again, very good. Michael Cannon, Kevin Cooney, all very good. So, there are green shoots for Galway if they can just put this aside very, very quickly.
Which they're going to try and do. But for me watching it, I looked yesterday and I watched Walter Walsh coming on and I'm thinking, my God, how could you not start him?
Yeah, and again, he wasn't alone. There was 2-4 came off the Kilkenny bench, and it's kind of interesting to see that. So they're kind of going with some of the older guys to finish out these games, like Walter, Park, Walsh, Killian Buckley, John Ream, Billy Drennan, who was the new kid on the block being raved about in the league. All these guys all made massive contributions. But look, Ruby, as I said, Marie, like Kilkenny are Kilkenny, and all the talk that we're talking about Munster hurling and everything, I've said it all the time, Kilkenny been lying in the background there, and they're just coming with a bit of freshness. I envisage Kilkenny being in the All-Ireland final. They have a bit to do to get to it yet, and I just think they're a very dangerous animal in the All-Ireland final. Like, consistently, they were league champions last year. They're, after amassing their fourth Leinster title without a word, they were pucking the ball away from winning All-Ireland. So I really think that they probably will be creeping closer to bookies favourites for this championship.
So you think they're ahead of Limerick?
I think, and I said it before, I think Limerick are the best team in the country. Just because they're the best team in the country doesn't necessarily mean you'll win the All-Ireland. And I do think Limerick have, they've used up an awful lot of energy, emotional, physical, in order to get to the stage that they've gotten to. And I suppose there's a little bit of collateral damage, and that injury is just kind of slowly starting to mount up. Whereas I think in Kilkenny's position, I just think they're going to be coming in mentally fresh. They'll have a bee in their bonnet if they were to meet Limerick in an All-Ireland final. And I just think even Adrian Mullen, like, he's not gone yet. His chances are he'll be back for an All-Ireland semi-final. I think Kilkenny are going to be a very dangerous animal. And I said, if you ask me, I'm taking off my Limerick hat. I just think that they're still the team that might just take this year's All-Ireland.
Well, you've
good way of getting pressure off Limerick too, isn't it?
Oh yeah, do that now, but you've got Limerick, Clare, Tipperary, probably Dublin, Kilkenny and Galway still in it. The hurling is far from over, even if the Munster and Leinster championships are. Thanks a million for taking our call, Niall. We will be back in touch during the rest of the summer.
Game on 2FM.
Welcome back. It's time now to talk football. Alan Cawley is with me in studio, Stephen Kelly is on the line, and Ruby is there as well. Just about, Ruby, I'd say.
Did you think I went to Emory?
You don't look very interested in talking to me now, I have to say.
I am. I'm just thinking of Champions League, like, after the hurling, you went, that's watching Champions League on Saturday night, and then you watched the hurling on Sunday, like, it was just talking cheese, like, Milan just set up for penalties, Alan, did they?
No, I think that's a bit harsh, Ruby, setting up for penalties, because if you're playing against one of the best teams that everybody is obviously saying, is this the best team we've ever seen, and all these kind of labels they're putting on them, but they're a brilliant team, as we know, you have to come up with some sort of a strategy where obviously you're trying to implement your game plan, that you're not going to allow them carve you open or give them the respect that so many teams do, to allow them the space to play to carve teams open. And I thought what Inter Milan did, it's not often you see Guardiola outwitted by a manager, but he was completely outwitted by Inzaghi because of what he did in terms of the tactics. And if you think of the numbers game that they were playing with three at the back, Man City, and moving Stones into the middle and Rodri, the two ahead of them, which makes up a five. What Inter Milan did to stop that from goal kicks, and when they were playing out, they dropped Martinez to the left, that Dzeko in the middle, and they pushed Barella out from midfield to the right-hand side. So that was matching up against City's back three. Then they had Brozovic and Kalinagulu matching up against Stones and Rodri. So they couldn't get out, and that's why, like, even listening to some of the analysis the weekend, people saying Man City were nervous and, oh, it was just an off performance. The reason, there was nothing to do with nerves. The reason Man City didn't play well is because they were pressed so hard, so aggressively by a brilliant organised set-up team, Inter Milan. And that's why you've seen them struggle. And even if you look at all the stats on the game, expected goals, Inter Milan are ahead. Goal attempts, Inter Milan are ahead. Shots on goal, Inter Milan are ahead. They had more corner kicks. And I'm not saying they were brilliant in terms of on the ball, but what they did off the ball was absolutely unbelievable, I thought, from Inter Milan. And when you think at half time, the only question I had was nothing about City, was just they had to raise the game and coming up with their solution, but was Inter Milan able to sustain it? That was the only question, because they put so much energy and so much intent into that first half in stopping City. I thought it was brilliant, and the only time they stepped out that we see Man City get down the side of them was the goal. Bastoni steps out and Bernardo Silva gets in behind him and it's a pullback, and even then they were well set up. It was Rodri who's coming in as the deep line midfielder, the one that finishes it. So they even were able to stop maybe some of the forward players getting on the end of the fullback. So I thought what Inter Milan did was absolutely brilliant. Then of course Man City were lucky at the end. Lukaku should have scored as well. And for all their brilliance, Man City, and what we've seen all year, it was the first time I've seen Guardiola outwitted and they needed luck to win.
Right, so after all of that, basically you told us that Inter Milan set up not to let City score. So that's playing for penalties.
Well, no, that's in your kind of language, but in the footballing world, it was nothing to do with that.
Stephen, the reality is, Stephen Kelly's with us as well, that Manchester City won, so they've won the treble. Pep got what he was aiming for the last few years. What can he do now with this team? I mean, like, he has all the money that he wants. He can get them playing loads of different ways. He can win easy games, or he can win tough games. What's next for this City team and for Pep Guardiola?
Same again, go again. That's what he does. You know, he's not won 5 titles in 6 years because he doesn't demand excellence and consistently wants his teams to up their ante, keep performing, keep improving. And I think that's what's so special about him. I think really is that he never lets off. You see, Klopp never lets off as well, but obviously he's got much more to the disposal when it comes to getting rid of players and bringing players in. Like, you can just get rid of someone like Cancelo, Zinchenko and Jesus, you know, and hasn't hampered them in any stretch of the imagination. I mean, they let them go to direct competition. Teams don't often do that, but Pep and City are capable of doing that because of the finances as well. But I think he's going to strive for more. You know, they've equaled United with the treble. If they do it again or go one more, then they better them. So I think it puts any kind of questions to bed. But yeah, I think it's a combination. I think Colley was right. The setup was fantastic from Inter. They pressed them. I think De Bruyne had gone off early, completely killed the game plan, because when City do go long, he's the one that links, and his timing of his runs are perfection. So that changed very much. So Inter having the high press, and then when City go long, the joining of Haaland and De Bruyne, so that was able to give Inter a little bit more joy. But I think overall they got the result, and I think, you know, City, I don't know, they go on again from this.
Okay, let's turn our attention now to Ireland football, because we're starting to get a few texts in about Tom Cannon, even though we haven't even mentioned him yet. It's a huge week for Ireland. They play Greece on Friday. They're in Turkey at the moment. Our own Tony O'Donoghue's out there. He actually spoke to Stephen Kenny today and asked him about Tom Cannon. For anyone who doesn't know, Tom Cannon is an Ireland under 21 striker. He has been approached to play with England. He has been capped at under 19, under 20 and under 21 level for Ireland, but now England are interested in him. That has been confirmed. Cannon is Liverpool born and he's qualified through his grandparents. Let's hear what Stephen Kenny had to say about him.
Finally, can I ask you about Tom Cannon? And I know you discussed it briefly yesterday. Is it disappointing to you that he's considering his international future now?
No, listen, I'm delighted with the squad we've got here. Tom's a young player, came into our under-19s in a COVID era, played for the under-21s in Cork, and he just needs a period of reflection. No problem. We're focused on what we have here. We're delighted with the players we have, and we'll see how that goes.
Stephen Kelly, thoughts on Tom Cannon and whether or not he should stick around?
It really depends on what he feels the level he can get to. At the moment, he's playing for Preston in the Championship and he's done really well. So if he has aspirations to play for England, that won't cut it. You know, it's not good enough. You need to be playing in the Premier League at a very high standard, at a very decent team, and playing week in, week out if you want to have any chance of succeeding, getting into the senior national team in England. So it's that's the question, whether he feels like he can get there, if the people around him, his representatives, the family believe in being able to get that. You know, there's not many players that take a decision at this young. Like Jack Grealish, he jumped and before he got to 21s level, he changed allegiance and actually changed his registration. It was extremely brave to go and do something like that. He didn't just say, okay, I'm going to play for England. He actually changed his registration, which meant he couldn't come back to play for Ireland, and he was nowhere near a senior call-up because he had so much faith in his own ability. And you know, you've got to give credit to that. And whereas Tom Cannon's slightly different, I think. He's been called the 21s. He's maybe England the 21s there. Lee Carsley's there. Cars is a great coach as well, so it's a very tough decision. And you know, this is the thing, you know, Evan Ferguson's the player talked about for England, and you know, luckily there's no way that's going to happen. I think, you know, everybody knows he's committed to the cause and he's very much bleeds green, but you know, there's going to be lads out there that are born in the UK that you know, playing for England is just as much as a joy for them as playing for Ireland would be.
One of the texts in that we got says, if Tom Cannon wants to play for England, then fair enough, but why play for Ireland in the first place? This isn't as bad as Grealish or Rice, as he's still just a prospect, but the FAI need to stop getting burnt with this, and it really emphasises that Ireland needs to produce its own players and not rely on other countries. This needs to be nipped in the bud ASAP. Whoever the player declares for can't be another saga, Alan Colley.
Yeah, to be fair to that texter, the FAI are not getting burnt by this. It's the rule. And the FAI are only playing players who obviously are coming across and want to play, like Grealish, Rice, all those lads. Then they get to the stage where the rule for me is the problem, because if you represent Ireland under 21, you should even know an under 18, under 19, you're an Irish lad or who you're going to play for. The problem with the rules is, because they qualify with dual nationalities because of their heritage or their family and whatever the case may be, and we see a lot more of it now, and we've benefited from that as well, is the fact that these lads get to the stage where Tom Cannon has had a great season with Preston, he'll go back to Everton now, and somebody's in his ear and thinking, you know, maybe you can declare for England because one day you might play for England, and there's agents involved and all sorts of things. But it's not that the FAI are getting burnt, it's just the fact that the rule is so shabby at the moment, in the sense that you can still play under 18s, under 19s, under 21s, whatever the case may be, and you still don't have to make a decision until you represent the senior team. And that's the problem. It's not that they're
even
getting burnt.
It's only a qualifier, isn't it? You can play friendlies.
So Rice played a friendly, and he's still. So that's
three
the problem.
Games.
And it's not that they're getting burnt, because Stephen Kenny wants Tom Cannon. If Tom Cannon says he wants to play for Ireland and wants to declare, he will happily have him, because he's a very good player and a very good talent. So it's not the case that they're getting burnt by it. The problem is the rule, and I think that's what needs to change, because you can't have lads. It's probably different for us though, because we're Irish and we know we're Irish and we want to play for Ireland. Stephen, the same, Ruby, yourself. Whereas this lad is from Liverpool. He's had the chance to play for Ireland. Now he's making strides in his career. He's an English lad.
And he's probably looking at Jack Grealish and Declan Rice as well.
But he's an English lad. Like Rice was English lad, Grealish was an English lad.
Stephen, is it worth more to him financially to be an English player than an Irish one?
Yeah, absolutely. I don't think there's any doubt about that. If you make it, that's the difference. Mm-hmm. This is a young lad, he's nowhere near that. Absolutely nowhere near. And that's not putting down his level or what he's at. It's just, you know, if you're playing 20 games of championship and score 8 goals, you're a million miles away from senior team England call up. You know, that's a massive story to get to. But you know, I'm sure his ability and talent, he's had faith in that. But financially, the rewards and the level you can play at and the major competitions you can pretty much guarantee to get to. If you can play for England or Ireland, you're pretty much guaranteed to go to every major tournament around. You're guaranteed to have a decent chance of getting to the latter stages of it. And you look at the money that's been demanded for English players, Jude Bellingham, Jack Grealish, the highest transfers, Declan Rice at the moment. Don't get me wrong, they're absolutely sensational footballers, but English players, they demand a premium.
They're 100 million pound players now. It's actually amazing.
So that's and it's a fact. That's just the way it is. Whether he can get to that level, you know, only time will tell. But like I said, at the moment, he's a long way off that. So you make a decision very early on in your career without actually knowing what the future is going to hold.
Al, what's he like as a player?
Yeah, very good. Yeah, and he's a great season with Preston. And that's why Stephen is delighted to have him, because especially at that top end of the pitch where we're struggling for centre forwards, he'd be one of the best that we would have if you could get him. But he's going to go back to Everton. I would agree with Stephen. He's nowhere near England level right now. He could be potentially in the future, but that's the decision the young lad has to make. But it's the rule is the problem, not him or anyone else.
Usually is the rules are the problem, Alan. Most walks of life. It's not the people breaking them, it's always the rules. Anyway, Alan Cawley and Stephen Kelly, thanks so many for taking our call. We overran at the start of the show, so we will have Conor Ireland tomorrow night to talk about Novak Djokovic. Marie, thanks a million. Thanks to Ronan, our producer, and that's it for this evening. RTE 2FM.